I chose as my title The Great Experiment because the idea of global governance has been germinating for thousands of years. All humanity, and particularly where the vital interests of our collective survival are concerned, must be self-governing.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Strobe Talbott is president of the Brookings Institution. He brings to that position a lifetime of study of public policy issues as a journalist, but also during the Clinton years as an important participant in the formation and execution of public policy. Strobe Talbott was born in Dayton, prepped at Hotchkiss, and was educated at Yale and Oxford. Since graduation, he served as a trustee of the Hotchkiss School, a fellow of the Yale Corporation, and as a member of the American Association of Rhodes Scholars. Talbott was a classmate of President George W. Bush at New Haven and of President Bill Clinton as a Rhodes Scholar. He spent 21 years at Time Magazine covering Eastern Europe, the White House, serving as Washington bureau chief, editor-at-large, and foreign affairs columnist. He went to the State Department early in the Clinton administration and then served 7 years as Deputy Secretary of State. He went to Brookings in July of 2002. He serves now as a member of the Miller Center's National Commission on War Powers. Strobe Talbott credits his parents, who were active in the internationalist wing of the Republican Party, with nudging him, in his words, at an early age towards an awareness of how far the world has to go in learning how to govern itself sensibly. He has spent most of his life and invested much of his very keen intellect in pursuit of sensible governance. He's written for all of the principal foreign policy journals and has published 5 books. He translated and edited 2 volumes of Premier Nikita Khrushchev's memoirs in the early 1970s. His most recent book is The Great Experiment, The Story of Ancient Empires, Modern States, and the Quest for a Global Nation. Please welcome Strobe Talbott.
George, thank you very much, both for the introduction and for the invitation to be here, and also thank you for already providing some evidence that you've actually read the book, and I do appreciate that. I feel like the Miller Center is a kind of a home to me. It's already been part of my life for a number of years. I've had the honor and opportunity to come down here and participate in the Presidential Oral History Project, along with my former boss, Warren Christopher. And also with Warren Christopher, I've been back down here along with another former Secretary of State, Jim Baker, to work under the leadership of Governor Belisles on the War Powers Commission. And over the years, Michael Crapon has even been good enough to let me make an appearance at a class or two of his. And Jerry, I want to thank you very much for being here this evening. Another bond that I have with this community and this university is standing right in the back of the room there, Bill Antholis, who's smiling, as I often seeing him do, is one of my very, very closest friends. He is also an indispensable colleague of mine at the Brookings Institution, and he's your neighbor, as well as my friend. Being your neighbor means that he has to commute for about 2.5 or 3 hours in order to be my colleague at the Brookings Institution. I might add that he has also been a collaborator and sometimes mentor of mine on some of the issues that we're going to be talking about this afternoon. So now, with your permission, let's get down to work. In the course of the discussion that I look forward to having with all of you folks, we're going to be talking about a range of very contemporary issues. So you may wonder why on the screen up here you're looking at a scene from 2,400 years ago. Bear with me, and I hope you will see that there is a connection between then and now. In this painting, the French romantic David captures the last minutes in the life of Socrates, just before the great philosopher, drinks the hemlock, thereby carrying out the death sentence that has been imposed on him by the ruling powers of Athens. Socrates suffered that fate, among other reasons, because he claimed to be not just an Athenian and not just a Greek, but a citizen of the world. And for this, he was charged with impiety, or as the accusation was formally known, refusal to accept the gods of the state. In the eyes of many of his contemporaries, that made Socrates a traitor. In the eyes of much of posterity, it makes him a hero. And it certainly makes him a hero in my book. And that's because he believed in the big idea that is the subject of the book, namely, that all humanity can and should be, and particularly where the vital interests of our collective survival are concerned, must be self-governing. I chose as my title, The Great Experiment, because the idea of global governance has been germinating in the laboratory of reality for thousands of years. So there's a lot of history in this book, hence the subtitle. And history, of course, as the name suggests, is a story. It begins with the gathering of tribes to form ancient empires. Those empires eventually break up and form the forerunners of modern states. They, in turn, band together in alliances and trade pacts and other arrangements to help regulate international life. In our lifetimes, the most ambitious and sustained effort to accomplish that task goes on here, on the banks of the East River in New York. And since Professor Innes Claude is here this evening, I should add that my own knowledge of the history and workings of the United Nations owe a lot to him through what he's written in his own books, as well as indispensable help that he gave me while I was writing mine. Now, I chose this picture for a particular reason, because I think it says a great deal. Note that the flags arrayed in front of the UN Secretariat building, they symbolize two features of the United Nations that are sometimes in tension with each other. First, the UN's nearly 200 member states retain their sovereignty. But while still sovereign, those nations, like their flags, often line up together and act collectively in pursuit of common goals. The UN system has many parts and many functions. Here, just to illustrate the diversity, are a few. The International Monetary Fund, which helps countries when they are in financial trouble. The International Atomic Energy Agency, which tries to make sure that nuclear fuel for generating electricity isn't used for making atomic bombs. The World Health Organization, which fights diseases around the world, sponsoring inoculation campaigns like the one shown here. And then there are peacekeeping missions, like that undertaken by these soldiers in Congo. Now, the UN is just part of an international system that operates out of cities all around the globe. Take, for example, the African Union, which is based in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And then there's the International Seabed Authority, which promotes sustainable use of the resources of the ocean and has its main offices in Kingston. Then the Asian Development Bank is on the other side of the world, here in Manila. And then as a final example, there's the World Food Program, which is headquartered another half a world away here in Rome. And by the way, this is one outfit that clearly has its work cut out for it now, given the international crisis over food. The list could go on, and so it does. There are more than 7,500 international organizations literally all over the map. Most have been around only for a few decades, and in some cases, just a few years. Yet together, they stand for something that is as old as humanity itself. the notion of mankind not just as a single community, but as a single family. Now, many cultures have religions that feature some version of the belief that we're all related. And many of us in this room come from a culture that traces the human story back to this couple, the ancestors, according to the Bible, of all 6+ billion people on the planet today. But the human family quickly became extended, complicated, and conflicted. Just look what happened in only the second generation. The peace of Eden gave way to the war of Cain versus Abel. The lesson? All wars are fratricidal. They're civil wars within the human family. So the question arose very early in the human story, how to suppress this tendency toward mayhem and chaos. One answer, which constituted an early and long-lasting phase of the great experiment, was empire. And one way to think about empire is as a giant construction project. Part of the purpose of empire was to bring fractious tribes and cultures together under a single authority so that they would not make war against each other. But the benefits of that transnational peace came at the cost of national freedom, which is why you're looking at this painting. Bruegel tells in a single picture the story that Genesis tells in 1,000 words. That story can be read as a parable about empire. Babel was the archetype of empire in its most ambitious and universal form. Its rulers saw the city as the capital of a global kingdom and themselves as the head of a world government. Yet neither the authors of the Old Testament, nor Bruegel, nor, most importantly, the God of Israel, saw Babel as a utopia. Quite the contrary, they saw the city as a dictatorship and the tower as a monument to imperial arrogance. In fact, there in the lower left-hand corner, you can see the arrogant emperor himself surrounded by his sycophantic ministers and engineers. And as for the edifice in the background, it makes no sense, architecturally or aesthetically. It's big for big's sake. But the real point is this: somewhere inside that tower, or in its shadow, were subject peoples who yearned to be free. Hence the ending and the moral of the story. The Lord confounded the language of this vast and all-inclusive empire and dispersed its inhabitants so that they could find their own lands, fly their own flags, and speak their own languages. That's what happened over the centuries with all empires, including these six: Egypt under the pharaohs, Babylon, the historical prototype of Babel, Rome under the Caesars, the Mongols under the great Khans, their descendants, the Mughals of South Asia, and the Ottomans under the Sultans. In these cases and in all others, nationalism proved stronger than imperialism. Dying empires gave birth to new nations, many of them forerunners of ones on the map today. You'll see on this slide how those six empires encompassed what are now about 40 different states, and they include the two largest in terms of population and also the largest in territory. Now let's take a look at a small nation, this one in particular, shown here in its 1967 borders. For small nations, achieving and reachieving nationhood took a long time. Israel was conquered by some 25 empires in the course of as many centuries. The more general point is that the birth of nations, like so much of the human story, was often bloody. And rarely was it more bloody than in Europe in the 17th century during the 30 Years' War. That conflict reduced by a third the population of much of the continent. Yet in all that bad news, there was good news. The protracted bloodshed that's barely hinted at in this painting led not just to peace, but to a new kind of peace. In the Treaty of Westphalia, representatives of the contending parties agreed to a relatively stable system based less on empire and more on what would become known as the nation state. One example on this map is a country called France, for a people who had come to think of themselves as French. But the Westphalian stability and the live and let live order among nation states was shattered when this particular Frenchman set about conquering countries in the name of liberating them. Here's how far Napoleon got before the Continental powers ganged up on him, defeated him decisively at Waterloo, exiled him to the farthest ends of the earth, and with him out of the way, entered into a marathon of diplomacy known as the Congress of Vienna. The purpose of the representatives of the 44 countries involved in that venture was to bring about what they called the Concert of Europe, which was an attempt, reasonably successful for a while, to reorder the political geography of Europe through a system that came to be known as the balance of power, a concept that was borrowed from elemental engineering and physics. It coexisted and to some extent competed with another concept borrowed from ancient philosophy, including that of Socrates, and from the ethics and philosophy of the 18th century Enlightenment, which promoted the ideas of the perfectibility of the human condition, the power of reason, and the rights of the individual. One major thinker of the Enlightenment has a special place in the intellectual history of the great experiment. Immanuel Kant's prescience was and remains a stunning refutation of the conventional wisdom about universities as ivory towers, and an exemplary reminder of how important ideas are to the world of affairs. This professor of metaphysics in the Baltic port of Königsberg argued that states must join together in a league or union that would uphold the principles of what he called a perpetual peace, and that such a peace would be possible only among nations that adopted democratic forms of government. Now, obviously, just from the way I put that proposition, Kant's ideas resonate today. But that's because in his own day, they resonated with what was happening on the far side of the Atlantic Ocean, namely the emergence not so much of a new nation state in the Westphalian sense as an idea state, a state based on universal values, including the proposition that all men are created equal and have a right to govern themselves. Kant might be thought of as an honorary founding father of the American Republic, having seen his own continent yet again tear itself apart over competing imperial ambitions, Kant looked with hope toward a self-liberated America, where one of his own signature ideas, namely the peaceful spread of republicanism, was championed by, among others, this university's own founder. Like Kant, Thomas Jefferson anticipated some of the core principles of 20th century U.S. foreign policy, a foreign policy that was both post-imperial and anti-imperial. But back in the late 18th and 19th centuries, the age of empire and European global dominance were far from finished. Here's what the world looked like when King George III was having trouble with his 13 American colonies. The orange indicates parts of the globe dominated by major European powers. By 1822, with the exception of the Western Hemisphere, European colonization was spreading. And by 1885, it was even more dramatic. By 1914, most of the Earth's territory consisted of countries that were imperial powers or colonies. And then something happened. The shot heard round the world. It was fired by a 19-year-old Serb nationalist who killed the heir to an imperial throne and set off a debilitating conflict among the great empires of the time. It was truly a world war. It had profound consequences for Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, the Indian subcontinent, and the Far East. New forms of military technology like tanks and mustard gas and tactics like trench warfare seemed calculated to guarantee stalemate and massive carnage on the battlefield. The toll was staggering. 8.5 million soldiers died. And so, by the way, did 13 million civilians. The casualties included whole empires as well. Those that collapsed into history were the Habsburgs, the Germans, the Ottomans, and the Romanovs. Those that were severely weakened were the British, the Dutch, and the French. But there was another important factor in the demise of empire, and that was the emergence of America as a world power, determined to advance those universal anti-imperial values on which our country was founded. Now, the most famous face, not in the posters, but in real life, of this new, robust, idealistic American internationalism was somebody who I was interested to find out is listed on the UVA website as a notable alumnus, based on a year that he spent in law school here. And there's a story about some trouble he ran into while he was here, but many of you know, I'm sure, better than I. In any event, Woodrow Wilson had famously taken the United States into the Great War to make the world safe for democracy. Yet his Republican opponents in the Senate, many of whom are, show in this picture here, refused to ratify the Treaty of Versailles, which created the League of Nations. And by the time that organization met in these grandiose new quarters on the banks of Lake Geneva, it was doomed. That was for several reasons. One was that in the absence of the United States, the League was dominated by representatives of imperial powers interested more in clinging to their far-flung holdings around the world than actually doing what Wilson had envisioned. But something else was going on, something new under the sun. In this painting of the League's officials at work, you can see the Alps in the distance. To the north and to the east of that mountain range, two new forms of governance were on the rise: Soviet communism and German fascism. These totalitarian regimes aspired to conquer the world. They were nightmare versions of the dream of global governance. After a brief alliance of convenience between these two, for purposes of dividing up the map between them, they ended up on opposite sides in World War II. The scope and devastation of that conflict set a new record in the annals of that human habit that the Bible traces back to Cain and Abel. Moreover, the Second World War had its ironies, and one was that it put Joseph Stalin into this company. And look at this picture. We've seen it a million times. It is a very odd trio. Stalin's ideal was a global dictatorship. Winston Churchill, for all of his virtues, was a diehard imperialist. Franklin Roosevelt, even though he would never have said so, was a Kantian internationalist. When he coined the phrase United Nations, which he did, by the way, 5 months before Pearl Harbor, he had in mind not just an alliance to defeat the Axis, but also a world organization that would maintain the post-war peace, an organization that he said would defend the right of all peoples to choose the form of government under which they will live. FDR, of course, did not himself live to see this vision fulfilled, but his successor, Harry Truman, did. In fact, Truman had an even bolder dream. All his life, he carried in his wallet a fragment of a Tennyson poem that foresaw a parliament of man and a federation of the world. Truman, in other words, was a believer, not just in global governance, but in world government. And so, by the way, were many of his contemporaries. The One World Movement was an idea whose time seemed to have come in the mid to late 1940s. Its enthusiasts included some of the most eminent figures of the time. Note the names of Albert Einstein and Walter Lippmann on the table of contents of this pamphlet. The movement also attracted some of the most promising up-and-comers, including two Navy vets who had just been elected to Congress, and by the way, also a political activist in Hollywood who had also just come out of the service. But the idea of one world quickly gave way to the reality of three. The first world, protected by a string of US-led alliances. The second world, a communist monolith that included China throughout the 1950s. And then all the rest, which were lumped together as the third world. For half a century, our globe was color-coded in this fashion. The Cold War turned hot in proxy conflicts like these, on the Korean Peninsula, in Indochina, especially Vietnam, in Africa, especially Angola, in Central America, particularly Nicaragua, and very importantly, in Afghanistan, which turned out to be the Waterloo of Soviet expansionism. But these hotspots were all outside the periphery of the first and second worlds. What was most noteworthy about this period was what did not happen, namely outright war between the United States and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And here is why that did not happen. What you've been watching and listening to here represented something entirely new in the long history of warfare. Earlier technological advances in weaponry, from the spear to the longbow, from the rifle to the machine gun, from the catapult to aerial bombing, had made war more destructive. But this device was a quantum leap so destructive that it made war between major powers suicidal and therefore obsolete. What you're looking at here is the so-called Tsar bomb, a Soviet fusion weapon 6,500 times more powerful than the fission one dropped on Hiroshima. It weighed 27 tons, which among other things made it too heavy for any Soviet bomber of the time to carry. So appropriately, it was consigned to a provincial museum like a dinosaur, and there it remains, a symbol of the fatal flaw of the ultimate weapon. Now, to be sure, the US and the Soviet Union had some standoffs and some hairy moments. And Mel Leffler, who's here tonight and with whom I've done some work, is an expert on that period. The most dangerous of such episodes, of course, was the one that occurred in October of 1962, when Nikita Khrushchev deployed nuclear missiles that could be launched at American cities from bases in Cuba, like this one seen in an aerial photograph. But that crisis was resolved. Moreover, the close call helped keep us from going over the brink in the decades that followed. And that was largely because the danger itself led to the creation of a complex set of bilateral and multilateral treaties. One that is still in force today began with the so-called Atoms for Peace proposal that Dwight Eisenhower made at the United Nations. That led to a series of test ban treaties, starting with one that John F. Kennedy signed. And that, in turn, led to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, here being signed by Lyndon Johnson's representative and the Soviet foreign minister. Then came the SALT I Anti-Ballistic Missile, or ABM, treaty between Richard Nixon and Leonid Brezhnev, and SALT II, signed by Jimmy Carter. The Strategic Arms Reduction Talks, or START, were begun by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, and then consummated by George H.W. Bush. And finally, there was the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, signed by Bill Clinton, who, by the way, went out of his way to find the pen that Jack Kennedy had used to sign the Test Ban Treaty in order to sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Now, this arms control and nonproliferation regime kept the peace between adversarial superpowers and their armed camps, NATO and the Warsaw Pact. But the first of those organizations, NATO, which was our side in the Cold War, was more than a military alliance that fended off aggression from the East. It was also a mechanism for promoting political and economic integration in the West. That happened first in the form of the European Coal and Steel Community, and then in the form of an expanding European Union that eventually brought in former Soviet republics and satellites. Now, with your permission, I'd like to ask that we sort of pause here for a moment and focus on a key feature of what happened during the 1990s after the end of the Cold War. With the end of the schism that had divided the world, the transatlantic community created the possibility of a trans-Eurasian one as well. And that new geopolitical potential has been kept alive by international organizations, in particular, these 17. Now, the names and the specific functions are not as important as their unifying purpose, which is to integrate what had been enemy camps into a single zone of peace and cooperation. When I was working in the State Department back in the 90s, I commissioned the CIA to come up with a graphic that would show what was really going on with the strengthening and expansion of transatlantic, trans-Eurasian structures. First, my colleagues at the agency, who had much better computer equipment than we did at the State Department, rearranged all of the countries involved by taking them out of their geographical context and clustering them in their institutional context, so that the member states of those 17 outfits that are listed at the bottom of the screen could be rounded up in elliptical corrals that illustrate how their memberships and missions overlap with and complement each other. My colleagues and I gave this chart a nickname. We called it the Euro Mess. But we used the term affectionately because we saw wisdom and even beauty in its messiness. When I look at this chart, what comes to my mind is a complex political galaxy with multiple solar systems that create a cumulative gravitational field exerting a pull on former communist countries so that they will ultimately come into the orbit of liberal values and institutions. A crucial point here, though, it's not just the number of institutions that matter. It's the unique importance, the valency, you might say, of the two organizations at the center, which is to say NATO and the European Union. Together, they provide the bonding force of security and common market and shared political values. Now, here's a slide illustrating our own hemisphere, which has the benefit of a diversified set of organizations and institutions that seek to promote cooperation and integration. By contrast, in other parts of the world, there are areas that are considerably less messy and correspondingly less peaceful. The supreme example is this region, which is virtually mess-free. It consists of exactly two organizations. The point here is that effective regional governance requires multiple mutually reinforcing transnational organizations. And that lesson, I think, can and should be applied globally as well. Part of what we must hope will happen in the years ahead, that there will be a more robust globo-mess, that is to say, a strengthening of regional organizations, and just as important, a strengthening of the ties among them. And as for the all-encompassing rings, we're also going to need to strengthen existing worldwide organizations and create new ones. And by the way, looking forward, I was very glad this morning to get an email from my friend Bill Antholos, who was giving me some last-minute prep for this afternoon's occasion. And it was a copy of an announcement from the Miller Center about how there's going to be a conference in September brainstorming on what global financial architectures might look like. And if we look backward, we can, I think, say safely that the international community can take pride in progress that has already been made toward creating new global structures. One example is the establishment of the International Criminal Court. This is a picture of Kofi Annan exchanging with the president of the court documents that link it to the United Nations. And here are the judges in The Hague after being sworn in 5 years ago, ready to begin the process of more effectively prosecuting those who commit crimes against humanity. Another important innovation was a protocol negotiated in Kyoto in 2000. It represented a first step toward universal rules that will, we must hope, slow down, stop, and ultimately reverse the process of climate change, a subject I will return to shortly. But first, I want to zero in on one of the stranger contrasts in the history of American foreign policy and indeed in the history of the American presidency. Our 41st president, George Herbert Walker Bush, was an advocate and I would even say a champion of a U.S.-led, rule-based international system. He called it a new world order. But then, 7.5 years ago, his son came into office with a very different vision and very different policies. During his first term, the current president withdrew from, suspended, or opposed a great number of treaties and agreements. Here's just a partial list, and you'll recognize the slides, I think. Very early on in his presidency, Mr. Bush pulled the United States out of the SALT I ABM treaty signed by Nixon. He shelved the START process that had been approved by his own father. He allowed the comprehensive test ban to languish without ratification in the United States Senate. He nullified President Clinton's signature on the International Criminal Court. He proclaimed dead the Kyoto Protocol. And as for the nonproliferation treaty that was conceived by Dwight Eisenhower and put into force under Lyndon Johnson, Mr. Bush has taken a number of steps that have weakened it and left its future under a question mark. Now, together, these all constitute just a few examples of Mr. Bush's unilateralism, his preference to go it alone in the world, and to operate on the premise that unbridled American power, that is, power unchecked by having to obey rules that apply to others, is a force for good in the world and will be welcomed as such. That was Mr. Bush's own not-so-great experiment on how best to advance U.S. interests and lead our friends and allies. And that experiment has failed, and it's failed in several respects, notably in its impact on support for and trust in the United States around the world, as you can see from this graph. Now, more recent polling has indicated that there has been some improvement in our international standing. That's partly a credit to President Bush, and it's because he has relied more in his second term on multilateral diplomacy and less on unilateral force. But it's also because world opinion is focused now much less on our 43rd president and more on the question of who will be sitting in this chair 217 days from today. Now, whoever that is will have a truly, and I would say unprecedentedly daunting inbox on that desk. What to do about Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, the Middle East peace process? Those questions are going to loom very large. But what will make our 44th president's job uniquely difficult and important is a pair of mega threats to the very survival of the planet. One is a 21st century version of what George F. Kennan once called the cloud of nuclear danger. and the other is the fast approaching specter of the scorching and poaching of the earth. Let us now deal with both problems and their potential solutions, one at a time, starting with nonproliferation. On this slide, you'll note a scoreboard in the corner. It will keep track of actual and potential nuclear weapon states. We'll start with the nuclear haves. Those are the five countries whose nuclear arsenals were grandfathered when the Non-Proliferation Treaty came into force. We should also keep in mind what might be called the nuclear has-beens. These are countries that actually possessed nuclear weapons in the past, but gave them up. Then there is one country, Israel, that is usually said to be assumed to have nuclear weapons, even though that's almost never officially confirmed. Then there are three countries that have tested nuclear weapons but are not members of the NPT. Additionally, we have to keep our eyes on what I'll call yesterday's wannabes, which are countries that were developing nuclear weapons but often under pressure from the United States agreed to stop doing so. That is, they stopped short of crossing the nuclear threshold. And then, of course, as we are reminded every day, there is today's wannabe, Iran, which must, if possible, be kept from crossing the threshold itself. The final category is tomorrow's wannabes, countries that might very well go nuclear in a future that is ungoverned by the NPT. So you see that the box score indicates that we're looking at a world with more than 20 nuclear-armed states. That is a very dangerous world indeed. So the obvious question is, what do we do about it? And quite simply, what we have to do is rescue the NPT. And that means running the box score backward, if possible, down to zero, just as the Non-Proliferation Treaty itself obliges us to do as the original signatory of the treaty. And that's going to be very hard, especially when we get down to the original nuclear haves, our own country included. The United States will have to commit itself to the goal of zero before anybody else conceivably will. And that will require a profound change in elite opinion. But that change may already be taking place. One straw in the wind is what these four elder statesmen are saying. You've got here Henry Kissinger and George Shultz, Bill Perry and Sam Nunn, two Republicans and two Democrats. For a year, they have been urging that abolition should be a long-term goal of U.S. policy. And they've been working ever since to build support for that idea in the United States and around the world. Let's shift now to that other problem, which is even more dangerous and, at its solution, even more urgent. These are the countries that emit most of the greenhouse gases that are causing global warming. They're often called the Dirty Dozen. What I'm going to do now is show you what could happen if we don't take drastic remedial action. The first graph shows, with this blue line, the steep increase in carbon dioxide emissions. Where the line is solid, that's the increase to date. Where it's dotted, the increase is projected into the future. Then, this red line shows the consequent warming of the planet. Now, let me explain why the red line is solid through 2030. It's because of the lingering effects of emissions. We are living today with the consequences of what our ancestors did when they pumped greenhouse gases into the air during the Industrial Revolution. And it follows that what we're pumping into the air now is going to stay with us for years, raising temperatures along this path until 2030, no matter what we do now. Now, please note the point that's highlighted in red. When the increase in the temperature of the planet hits 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit around the mid-century, that is the increase in planet temperature. If we exceed that threshold, the result could be irreversible and catastrophic for many species of life on Earth, including our own. So what's the solution to this problem? Well, in a way, once again, it's self-evident. We have to put caps on carbon emissions in order to flatten out the steep upward curve. And it's only by doing that that we're going to be able to bend downward the curve of temperature increase. Now, just so you can keep in mind what a change this represents, let me remind you what those earlier lines looked like. Here you see the what you will call the business as usual slide superimposed. And once again, you can also see where that critical point of no return of an increase of 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit is that we must avoid. We have to act now to prevent the dangerous increase in temperature from continuing beyond 2030. That is really the challenge facing us immediately. And how do we do that? The short answer is by reducing carbon emissions. As I go through this slide, note how the carbon line tilts downward. That will require a whole battery of measures, only some of which I'm going to show you here. They include improving energy efficiency, planting new forests, improving the management of methane, which is a byproduct of coal mining, and by the way, is also produced in vast quantities in a fairly basic fashion by livestock. And then there's improving vehicle efficiency and capturing or sequestering carbon, particularly at coal power plants, and expanding our use of so-called renewables, especially solar, wind, and hydroelectric power. And then finally, using nuclear power instead of fossil fuel power. Doing all this, and doing it soon, will require us here in the United States, among many other things, to retire dirty coal plants and overhaul our transportation infrastructure so that we don't have this sort of polluting nightmare as part of our daily lives. These and many other measures are not only necessary, but urgent. They are going to entail great difficulty. They will involve incurring very high costs, they will require sacrifice, and they will require changes in the way we live. Moreover, on a worldwide basis, they're going to constitute a test of our ability to take global governance to a whole new level. And more specifically, it's going to require, I believe, a new institution. You'll remember the GloboMess chart. In a nutshell, what the international community is going to need now, in addition to all of these organizations and structures, is another all-encompassing organization, namely a successor to the Kyoto Protocol that is dedicated to setting and applying the rules required to bring global warming under control. Think of it as a world climate organization, roughly modeled on the World Trade Organization, and only it must be significantly more effective. And Jerry, if I understood the announcement at the beginning of the meeting correctly, you're going to be having a conference on precisely this subject later in the year. Now, getting something like this up and running in time is an almost unprecedented challenge. Why do I qualify that with the word almost? Well, partly it's because I'm an optimist. But it's also because history is mostly, though not totally, discouraging. Over the millennia, it almost always took massive breakdowns in the Great Experiment to make possible breakthroughs of the kind that we now need. Look at the examples that we've touched on earlier. It took the 30 Years' War to bring about the Treaty of Westphalia. It took the Napoleonic Wars to set the scene for the Concert of Europe. We had to suffer through World War I before we could even have the false start of the League of Nations, and we had to go through World War II before we had more success with the United Nations. So what do those cases all have in common? They have this. Progress, such as it was reactive. And in dealing with climate change, we need to be proactive. And history gives us really only one consoling precedent that we may be up to the challenge. The danger of World War III was enough to inspire a proactive non-proliferation and arms control regime that kept the Cold War from going critical. In other words, we didn't have to experience Armageddon in order to head it off. The looming menace was enough. And let's hope the same will be true with respect to a global meltdown, both in getting us to face up to the magnitude of the danger and, even harder, getting us to take the steps necessary for a proactive climate control regime. In conclusion, let me stress that this is not something we should think of as tomorrow's problem or as the next generation's problem. It is today's problem. It is an immediate problem. And it's going to have to be addressed big time by one of these two individuals. Let's assume that the winner in November serves two terms in office. That means his presidency is going to coincide with what may turn out to be our last chance to turn the corner on climate change. That, in turn, means that he, more than any of his predecessors, is going to be responsible for generations to come. In fact, I would go further than that and say responsible for all generations to come. And let me dramatize that point by taking us back to the slides that we were looking at a moment ago, only this time underscoring why all of us should take their message not just seriously, but personally. Turning the corner on climate change means bending those upward curves enough to keep the planet livable. We, those of us who are adults today, will probably get through our lives without reaping the consequences of human-induced climate change. It's one of the consolations of mortality. But there is a generation already alive that may not be so lucky. I'm going to show you three members of that generation, chosen not quite at random. Pay attention, Bill. Here are Annika and Kiri and Tholis. And here is Lola Talbot, my granddaughter. Just think of them as stand-ins for the roughly 2 billion children that we share the planet with today. And if I could, given sort of the nature of this room, let's see a show of hands. How many of you have children, grandchildren, or for that matter, great-grandchildren, who are more or less in this age group? Well, that's pretty impressive. Okay, here's a second question, and I won't even ask for a show of hands because I think I know what the answer is. When their generation gets to the year 2060, and those little girls and all of their contemporaries are in their 50s, do we want their world to be here at that point on the curve where global warming becomes irreversible, or do we want it to be here with the planet on this trajectory with some chance of its escaping the worst consequences of global warming? The answer, I think, is easy. But achieving that goal is not. And it'll depend to a large extent more on choices that we make now than on choices that their generation will have the luxury to make decades from now, which means that we Americans must live up to the ideal that this fellow gave his life for. For if we fail to recognize our own obligations as citizens of the world, we risk, if not our own lives, then those of our children and theirs. I'd like to kind of look at that picture and imagine that that's the point Socrates is making in this picture. It's certainly the one I'm making at the conclusion of this lecture. Thank you very much.
I'm going to move to the back of the room, and I will invite those who have questions to meet me in the back of the room, and we'll take as many as we have time for. Strobe, while I'm moving to the back of the room, let me sort of prime the pump with this. In the current issue of Foreign Affairs, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice writes as follows: "We recognize that democratic state building is now an urgent component of our national interest, And in the broader Middle East, we recognize that freedom and democracy are the only ideas that can, over time, lead to just and lasting stability, especially in Afghanistan and Iraq. How does this definition of our national interests address the two existential threats that you identified, and how or to what extent would either of the major party presidential candidates embrace that conception of national interest?
Let me take the second half of the question, George, first. Having, as you all have, paid pretty close attention to what Senator McCain and Senator Obama have been saying, I think both of them would accept the Kantian or Jeffersonian roots of American foreign policy and say that the promotion of democracy is not just an American, in the American interest and an American goal, but that it's a universal one. And they would accept the notion that a world made up of democratic states is going to be a more peaceful and prosperous world. Senator McCain has been active in the International Republican Institute, which engages in democracy promotion around the world. He's even called for a League of Democracy. Now, I've heard him explain it in different ways, insofar as it represents an alternative to the United Nations. I don't think it's a great idea. Insofar as it's a kind of caucus within the United Nations, it might make some sense. But he's certainly committed to that. And Senator Obama has also endorsed the promotion of democracy. That said, I think where both of them would distance themselves from President Bush, and by the way, one of the interesting dynamics we have here is a Republican and a Democratic Republican and Democratic candidates to be President Bush's successor who are going to try to outdo each other in distancing themselves from the incumbent president. But I think they would both acknowledge, not least because of the experience of the last 8 years, that democracy promotion is a long and difficult and perilous process. And it certainly cannot be undertaken in a quick fix fashion. It requires institutions within countries, the development of political culture that often doesn't exist within countries, and international institutions that will provide an umbrella of security over countries so that they can afford to become democratic, which is, of course, one of the themes in my talk. Now, how does the promotion of democracy relate to the nonproliferation and climate change issues? I think in the case of nonproliferation, it's kind of a no-brainer in one sense. It does not require a great deal of sacrifice on the part of populations to have their governments reduce levels of nuclear weaponry. In fact, it saves money, assuming that deterrence remains in place. Climate change is another matter. And the only way in which we are going to have climate change addressed in anything like the time frame where it will do our species some good is if it not only has outstanding leadership from the top, that is national leaders, like the President of the United States, it also has to have grassroots support. There has to be, whatever you want to call it, pressure on recalcitrant leaders or support for bold leaders. And that can only happen in democratic states.
I wholeheartedly endorse your conclusions and recommendations, but I think you omitted one very important issue. If you ask me what one of the worst things that the current administration has done was to cut off support for family planning and Planned Parenthood worldwide. And the population explosion that we're in the worldwide right now is probably the source and the core of global warming and many of the problems we have today. I would like you to comment about that, please.
I can comment very briefly. I totally agree. And I plead guilty to being, I felt I was taxing your patience with the points that I chose to emphasize. I think the list of crucially important issues, which are among other things challenges to global governance, certainly include population. It also includes global poverty, reducing the gap between those in the world who feel like winners and those who feel like losers in the process of globalization. It includes getting right the relationship between food and security, which we're seeing gotten very wrong right now. And it includes global public health. So all of those belong in the list. I just chose, both in the book and in these remarks this evening, to zero in on the two issues which, if we don't solve them, will kill us. If we don't get these two things right and do so soon, it doesn't matter what progress we make 20, 30, 40 years from now on those other issues, because it'll be too late. So that's why I concentrated on those two. But I think you're quite right to put the stress you do on the population issue.
Thank you for organizing the material so effectively to promote the dialogue. I'll stick with one question here. Noting that the inclusion of nuclear power in the list to reduce global warming is practically antithetical to reducing the number of nuclear weapon states to zero, which do you think is the greater threat? 24, two dozen rogue states with nuclear weapons capacity, or 12 rogue states with global warming capacity?
I don't accept the premise of the question. I do not think that the tension necessarily has to be as stark as you say. But you are absolutely right to make the point that you do. There is an inextricable link between the two issues that we're discussing with particular emphasis this evening. I happen to believe that the climate change threat is sufficiently dire and requires such a multitude of responses that that list must include truly clean and truly safe, those are two very important caveats, nuclear generated electricity. But in order to make sure that that peaceful use of nuclear energy remains peaceful, and that the fuel for nuclear reactors, and there are going to be a lot more in the world, if we're going to lick the problem of climate change, doesn't get into the hands of bad actors, we have to have a greatly strengthened non-proliferation treaty. So I would take the logic of your very good question and turn it around and simply say, precisely because of the point you make, we have all the more reason to strengthen the NPT.
Hi. I was interested in learning from you about what the attacks on the United Nations as an efficient organization, what kind of toll it's taken on the United Nations, and whether it's been a useful attack, a necessary attack, or not.
I think it's largely been, I'm now going to assume from your question that you're talking about the really hard-edged denunciatory attacks, as opposed to what I would call constructive criticism that that is good for any institution, including perhaps even the Miller Center and the University of Virginia, certainly the Brookings Institution. But I'm assuming you're talking about, I don't have a slide with Mr. Bolton's picture on it, but I could put that up there, that kind of thing. I think it is without redeeming value. It is entirely cynical and entirely destructive and entirely unfair and entirely stupid, not least because it misses, particularly when it comes from an American, because it misses a key point. And read Innes Claude's books, plural. The United Nations is an imperfect instrument, but it's a lot like what Winston Churchill said about democracy, and you all know what that is. If we didn't have it, we would have to invent it, and we probably wouldn't be able to invent it now. It has the virtues of being a universal organization, and it has the chaos and the messiness and the inefficiencies of being a universal organization. But the key point is, the United Nations is and will be as strong as its strongest member wants it to be. And you know who that is. Us. And there's obviously lots that can be done to reform it. A lot of its structures, most particularly the Security Council, are antiquated. They're essentially leftovers from the post-World War II era as opposed to the post-Cold War era, and we're going to have to work over time to buttress the UN while it undergoes reform. I think one of the problems with the UN is that people expect too much of it. Going back to the issue of peacekeeping in particular, since the UN does not have any force of its own it can call on, it always has to kind of scramble and put together forces on an ad hoc basis, very often lagging behind rapidly developing horrible events. And one point I was making kind of glancingly in these remarks was that we need to strengthen regional organizations under the auspices of the UN so that they can serve in a kind of, sort of in a spirit of federalism, if I can put it that way, to advance United Nations goals in their region. And I think actually there's some good news in that, particularly in Africa, where the African Union is beginning to develop some capacity in that regard. There are plenty of other parts of the world where that's missing, but over time we have to hope to see it there too.
Strobe Talbott will be signing copies of his book in the ante room after we leave. And let me ask everyone to please stay in their places until he leaves the room so that he can get to the place where he needs to sign. Strobe Talbott would not let me look at the end of his talk. And so I didn't know what the punchline was going to be, but I can tell you that you have done a terrific job of teeing up the conference with the very important issue that Governor Beliles is going to be addressing this fall. You've shined a very bright light on it and added a lot of clarity to it. So for that, we're very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, George, and thanks to all of you.